This is West Virginia Morning. I'm Beth Voorhees. It's 7:35. The name Wheeling is an old word. While there is some dispute, it's most commonly translated from the Delaware language to mean place of the skull. That's the name and subject of a recently published book. Glennis Board spoke with Ohio Valley resident and author of this book, Alan Fitzpatrick, and brings us this report.
Wheeling is not an English word.
An interest in genealogy pointed Alan Fitzpatrick down a dark path of the history of the Ohio Valley. It's a history so bloody that traces of 200-year-old atrocities are still prominent today in unexpected places.
In the Delaware language, there's two words linked together, wheel-lunk, wheel-lunk, wheeling. And lunk means place of, and wheel means head or skull.
Wheeling is nicknamed the Friendly City, but the name itself, Wheeling, actually has ominous beginnings.
What happened here? Mm-hmm. Something happened. Indians did not name places randomly for no reason.
Legend has it that Wheeling is the place where an early white settler was murdered by natives. His severed head was put on top of a pole as a warning to other settlers. But until now, no one has ever really tried to substantiate the story. Fitzpatrick first learned about the legend from Wheeling historian Margaret Brennan. He dedicated the book to her, in fact, and credits Brennan in part for inspiring him to investigate the matter. But there were a couple of other motivating factors behind him undertaking this investigation. Place of the Skull is actually the third book Fitzpatrick has written about 18th century indigenous Americans. His interest was sparked in the subject when he began to look at his own family tree. He discovered one of his American ancestors fought with native tribes and the British during the Revolutionary War against other Americans. Fitzpatrick then discovered there were many who fought with the indigenous people.
The American side did not know how many white men had gone over to the Indians who were sympathetic, who could speak the language, who were with them fighting against their own people.
He discovered this overseas in England, where he found a treasure trove of historical documents meticulously taken and maintained by the British before and during the American Revolution. Some 42,000 letters and documents exist there, Fitzpatrick says, and were the basis of his first book, The Wilderness War on the Ohio. Those same documents also informed Place of the Skull.
I came across many references in letters written by these white men who were fighting with the Indians, who are writing letters to the British, who are mentioning a place called Wheeling. That the Indians are talking about Wheeling. These are Indians who have never been to Wheeling. For some reason, Wheeling holds a certain spell over them. And when you read the letters, you get the feel of it. They're always talking about Wheeling. And this was as a place, almost like a place of mind, not a exact spot.
Fitzpatrick also notes a war tactic anomaly that captured his curiosity. The last battle of the American Revolution was fought in Wheeling. Fitzpatrick explains it was peculiar because the fort in Wheeling wasn't a significant post, nor could it be taken easily. And yet, for 3 days they tried.
Why would Indians spend 3 days attacking a fort when that went against every principle of warfare that they understood and had practiced?
Fitzpatrick was intrigued. So he began a search to discover the story behind Wheeling.
I had to approach it like this was a cold case. And I'm not going to come up with a body. And I'm not going to come up with people who can testify. I've got to find some very tight circumstantial evidence. And so I started to roll the clock back.
The search led to studying 18th century indigenous customs, especially those regarding a man's skull being severed from his body and put on display atop a planted post. not an especially easy task.
I can count on one hand the number of instances recorded from 1710 to the end of the French and Indian War when Indians severed a man's head and put it on a post. They didn't do this for recreation. It was not a random act of violence.
Fitzpatrick points out that white people had very little insight to the native mindset then, and so we naturally still have a very shallow understanding of their perspectives. But he has been able to glean some understanding by interviewing modern indigenous Americans schooled in traditional cultures.
To us today, if we see that man injure that person over there, or kill that person, slay them, that man is guilty of the act, and that for whatever the motive is, and we're going to punish him. But in Indian understanding of things, 18th century, there is no difference between an evil act and an evil person and an evil place. They are one and the same. There is an evil spirit. And so the skull on the post is a warning to Indians, you see, that there's something bad has happened here to us.
So Fitzpatrick dove into research to try to piece together an event that would merit a warning that still lingers today, 200 years later. For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Glynis Board in McMeekin.
Tomorrow, what Alan Fitzpatrick discovered in his quest to find out how Wheeling came to be called the place of the skull. This is West Virginia Morning at 7:42. Partly sunny skies today. There's a slight chance of some rain and thunderstorms this morning. Temperatures in the mid-80s. Becoming partly cloudy overnight with lows in the 60s. Dense fog early Friday morning. Then mostly sunny skies tomorrow. Highs near 90 degrees.
Support for West Virginia Public Radio is provided by thousands of West Virginia artists at Tamarack, the best of West Virginia and Beckley, where everything is Mountain State made. Facebook.com/TamarackWV.
Kids from the surrounding areas were in Huntington this week taking part in Arts and Bots, exploring robotics and the arts. Clark Davis has more about this unique experience.
Students from grades 2 through 5 were on campus at Marshall learning how to build robots.
So what do you think we need to do? I think we need to glue down this cape right here. If we glue down this cape...
That's Heather Scarberry, a teacher for the Arts and Bots program at the June Harless Center for Rural Education Research and Development at Marshall. She's working with kids through today as the four-day camp on Arts and Bots wraps up. All week, these students have been working on building their own superhero robot. They hope that by the end of the week, they can make the robot walk, talk, or light up.
Each student has taken the opportunity to design their own robot, their own superhero with their own superpower, and now we're... Several adults around the room are just working on programming and designing and helping them get their robot to be what they expected it to be.
The robots are put together with common household items like empty water bottles or boxes that were once filled with pop or soda. Using a computer program, they are able to hook up the robot and then make it work. They can make it do things like roar. Or they can make a propeller move with the hopes it may be able to fly. Drea Parker is headed into the second grade and is building a robot likeness of herself, as if she was a superhero.
Kind of like a Wonder Drea, because that's my name.
It's projects like this one that has Carrie Megan Quick of the June Harless program excited. She hopes the kids find a new appreciation for the science, technology, engineering, arts, and math disciplines.
As West Virginians, a lot of our children aren't exposed to these things on a daily basis or even in their school. And we think that all children have the ability to grow up and be scientists and engineers. And we want to expose them to that and have them change their thinking about that.
The project was originally started at Carnegie Mellon University as a way to get young girls interested in the STEAM areas.
You know, Arts and Bots is very open-ended, so the students can make it whatever they want. They can make a superhero, they can make an animal, they can make a doll. So for students that are creative or good with crafts, those are things they're familiar with, and so they're comfortable. Then it also engages the students that are comfortable with technology, that like to wire, that are hands-on doing things like that. So it really engages both ends of the spectrum.
Landon Mosser, a fourth grader, has aspirations of a robot that can fly.
A planecopter. It's a plane and a helicopter combined. I'm going to make it try to fly. I want it to move its arms, move its legs, and do all kinds of stuff.
Heather Scarberry says the camp is a chance to see that technology is more than a smartphone or tablet.
This allows them to see that technology is beyond video games and beyond the cell phone and beyond texting. It's something that's very manageable for them. We also want them to be excited and engaged so that they can begin to think of careers that they could possibly choose.
The camp finishes up today on campus. For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Clark Davis in Huntington.
The best eighth graders in social studies and the arts from various counties spent a week learning about West Virginia's history. One of the events was a scavenger hunt. Liz McCormick has more.
Okay, you guys ready?
Yeah.
Okay,
let's go.
Okay, guys, back here.
Summer Street's back there.
Have fun!
That's one of seven groups of eighth graders participating in the West Virginia Ambassadors Camp's annual scavenger hunt. The search began at Davis Park, and they searched for 16 locations on their scavenger hunt list.
Have you guys found anything else?
Found a little man up there.
Oh.
With
very good.
Tim Brady with the Charleston Convention and Visitors Bureau hosted the scavenger hunt for about 70 students.
We've designed this photo scavenger hunt to lead teams strategically throughout the city so that they can see some of what Charleston has to offer, some of the architecture of the city, some of the parks and recreation offerings that we have. So it's our way of giving these kids an urban experience and then using a tool to get them out into the city so that they can see what Charleston has to offer.
Each group was given a paper, one side with a map of downtown Charleston and the other side with pictures and clues. Matthew Austin, one of the coordinators with the Convention and Visitors Bureau, says that the kids have a blast with the scavenger hunt.
Kids don't say it, but they like to be outside. I think that's just a human nature to want to be outside, to want to do fun things. So it kind of engages them to be outside, be active. And I think that's something that we really need, period, in the world today.
Well, you guys are the first group back, so
that's because we're awesome like that.
Woo!
Group 7 found 15 out of 16. We've already checked their answers and they were right.
The winning team of this year's scavenger hunt won restaurant gift cards and the respect of their peers as knowing the most about Charleston. For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Liz McCormick in Charleston.
West Virginia Morning is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, which is solely responsible for its content. Keep up with all the latest West Virginia news throughout the day on our website, wvpublic.org. We're interested in your comments. You can send them to feedback at wvpublic.org. Follow us on Twitter at wvpublicnews and find us on Facebook. Support for our news bureaus comes from Shepherd University, West Virginia University, Marshall University, and Concord University. Our producer is Beneduccio. Our director is Bill Lynch. I'm Beth Voorhees.